Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science, across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, I'm thrilled to reconnect with him after, more than a decade, and he's taken the most fascinating journey into bringing something novel into community oncology practice. My guest today is Dr. Justin Call. Justin, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Hey, Ross, great to see you again. And thanks so much for inviting me onto this podcast. I'm really happy to be here. I would describe myself as a CEO. And by CEO, I mean community experienced oncologist. I think I am a community oncologist by heart, and that's how I see myself. But I also am a full-time phase one principal investigator in a community setting. So I kind of wear both of those hats, community oncology and fully dedicated to early phase clinical trials. Personally, I'm also a husband of 25 years, a father of three, including one son with special needs, uncle, cousin, big brother, and cat owner. And last but not least, I would like to say that I'm a former fellow at the University of Colorado, where I was mentored by a young Ross Kamage. That's how I would introduce myself.
For a brief moment there, I thought you were going to say I've been married for 3 years and I have 25 children.
There are some people here who would answer to that, but not me.
All right. So we've got to find out. Where do you work?
So I work at Utah Cancer Specialists, which is a community practice based in Salt Lake City, although with offices up into Idaho. And so that's where I work. Our phase one program is called START Mountain Region. It's part of the START Global Phase One Network that has different sites across the country and actually in Europe.
Does START stand for something?
It stands for South Texas Accelerated Research Therapeutics. So that's where it was founded in South Texas, actually in San Antonio. And so that's where the moniker comes from. But now it's just START because it's more of a national or even global brand, I guess you will. So there, but that's what it. That was the initial abbreviation for it.
All right. Well, let's dig into Dr. Call. So where were you born and brought up?
So I was born in a town called Logan, Utah, which is about 90 miles north of Salt Lake City. It's a college town. It's the location of Utah State University. So the University of Utah, where I went, is in Salt Lake City, but Utah State University is in Logan. It's an agricultural college. So they're a mascot are the Aggies, and that's where my parents went, and that's where I was born. But I grew up mostly in Salt Lake City.
Tell me what your parents do for a living, or did for a living.
Yeah, so my father was a certified public accountant, and my mom was a public school teacher, mostly taught third grade.
And you told me your mom was like the third generation of public school teachers.
Yes, third generation. So her grandmother, her mother, and her were all public school teachers in the Utah public school system. And so that's where I was educated in the public school system. And our family has pretty soft hearts for public educators who do, I think, a lot of work with sometimes not as much support as they deserve.
No, absolutely. And you have one sibling?
Two siblings.
Two siblings?
Are two younger sisters.
And we know what you're going to end up as, but what did they end up as?
Yeah, so I have one sister who's 1 year younger. She works in kind of technology marketing in San Francisco and public relations and marketing. And then I've got another sister who's 7 years younger, and she works as an attorney here in Salt Lake.
So I think I touched on this before, and you have a cute answer. So you look at you and, you know, your dad's an accountant, your mom's a public, you know, school teacher, a lot of doctors around you. So how'd you end up in medicine?
Yeah. So not a lot of doctors directly around me, but my mother has five brothers And four of those brothers are doctors, including one who's an oncologist, who was an oncologist. So at family reunions, get-togethers, I spent a lot of time around them. They would tell these really interesting stories and facts about medicine, about their experiences in medicine. And so although direct family, no, but you know, just extended family, quite a few physicians in the family.
So when did you think about doing something other than medicine?
So at one point I was thinking about engineering. I enjoy kind of both science and math and the application of that. So, and I took some engineering classes in college, but I kind of didn't have a passion for it that I thought I did with medicine. And so I thought about engineering, but ultimately decided on medicine.
What did you major in your undergraduate degree?
Chemistry.
Okay. And that was that just a means to an end to get into medical school?
Yes.
Okay. So how did you decide which medical school? How many places did you apply?
Yeah. So I applied, I would say, to about 10 different locations, including the University of Utah. And I was accepted to three of those schools. And one of those was not the University of Utah. But I was accepted to the University of Colorado, which is, you know, not too far away. And so I chose to enroll at the University of Colorado School of Medicine in 1997.
Wow. And you did all of your medical training at the University of Colorado?
I did. I did medical school, residency, and fellowship, all at the University of Colorado.
And as you would, I mean, you end up an oncologist, but when did the oncology, you know, bug start calling?
Yeah, so I had an inclination that that's what I wanted to do when I started medical school. But it's interesting because at each rotation, especially as a third year and fourth year medical student, and even into residency, I was kind of became interested in what my last rotation was. So like, oh, this cardiology, this is really interesting. I think I might want to be a cardiologist. And then the next month would be GI. Oh, I'm kind of interested in GI. Maybe that's what I want to do. So I kind of tinkered mentally with some other specialties and kind of thought that. But then I had an experience as a fourth year medical student that really kind of made it clear to me that I wanted to do oncology. And if it's all right, I'll share that.
Oh, please do.
So I was a fourth year medical student at the University of Colorado. And as a fourth year medical student, you can choose some electives. So there's things that you can choose to do, clinical rotations and things. And so I chose to do a rotation with a community group there. It was called Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers. I think it's still there at the time. And I went over, and it was mostly an outpatient experience. And I followed one of their doctors around for about a month. And I was, I think it's not an understatement to say I felt blown away. I mean, I really didn't know what outpatient oncology was. I kind of had an exposure to inpatient oncology, which is, you know, patients either not doing well because they're having toxicity from treatment, they need to be in the hospital, or they're not doing well because the treatment's not working and their cancer's progressing and they need to be in the hospital. And this outpatient experience was just eye-opening. I mean, we would walk around. I mean, at the time, it was a community practice. So it was, you know, first patient had colon cancer, the next patient had diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, the third next patient had kidney cancer. And the doctor that I was following, just he seemed to know everything about everything. And I was just, it was just unbelievable how much he knew about everything. And these patient interactions were pleasant. They were filled with laughter and joking. And it just, it was totally a different experience. And I remember after about 2 days there, I was thinking, this is what I want to do. And that's who I want to be.
Wow.
And it kind of solidified that in. And as a fourth year medical student, when I was in residency, though, again, after each rotation, I would have some kind of inkling about, well, maybe this or maybe that. But I eventually came back to oncology. And that experience is, as a community practitioner, was really formative for me.
Would you like to give a shout out to the name of the doctor who you wanted to be like?
Yeah, he still practices there. I think it's Dr. Jeff Mattis.
There you go.
He works at the Colorado Blood and Cancer Institute now, mostly in myeloma. But at the time, we were seeing all solid tumors, and it was really an unbelievable experience. I've kind of kept touch with him over the years as well. So yeah, it was quite an experience.
Wow. And I remember when I encountered you, you were maybe a second year oncology fellow. I think I just arrived off the boat, you know, wet behind the ears, and you were like my introduction to America. And so it's entirely your fault that I'm still here.
Well, I remember those days well, yes.
Yeah. And even then, it was clear, you know, I'm just going to toot your horn for a second here. You're incredibly smart and you wrote beautifully, but your heart was in community practice. You were never going to want to be an academic oncologist as your primary job. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. Yes, that's fair to say. I liked certain aspects of academic oncology. One of the aspects that I liked was the clinical trials. I liked that part of it, but I didn't want to be restricted to one tumor type or one group of tumor types. I kind of wanted to see everything and treat everything. And so I liked some aspects of it, but no, my heart was never really into becoming an academic oncologist. Although I wasn't repulsed by it.
Well, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. So let me back up a wee bit. So during your training, when did you meet your wife?
So as a fourth year medical student, so in 2000, well, we met in 1999. And then I was married in 2000.
And what does your wife do?
She has a master's in computer information systems and also has a master's in special education. So she's done quite a bit over her career. Most recently kind of working with special needs children, particularly those with autism. That's been a passion of hers. She's not currently working now, but was doing that kind of for most of our married life.
So where were you in your career when the children arrived?
So our first daughter was born in 2003. I was a second year in a residency. So after medical school, but before graduating before finishing residency, was in 2003 when she was born.
And then your two other children?
Our second child, the son, he was born in 2007. And then our third was born in 2011. You'll notice they're 4 years apart. We could really only handle one child at a time, both mentally and probably financially in the beginning. But as a result, I'm currently paying for college 1 year at a time for 12 years. So it'll be fine. But yeah, they're 4 years apart.
So let me ask you a personal question, if you're okay with this. So when did you realize your son was on the autism spectrum?
Yeah, so he was born in 2007 in Colorado, and I finished fellowship in 2008. And so he was 1 year old when we finished fellowship. And we moved to a town called Petoskey, Michigan, which was a hospital-employed group. It's kind of in northern Michigan. It was for a loan repayment. It was a nice hospital. It had a nice community. And he was about 18 months old when we kind of thought that something might be not quite off. It, you know, a lot of times when you have little kids and you're doing something together, there's kind of this shared attention, meaning they're paying attention to something that you are also paying attention to. You're reading a book, we're both looking at the book, or you're thinking. And we would do things with him, and his attention would be elsewhere from the group. And then he had that was kind of looking back, we noticed that, although it didn't kind of register as much, I think, in the beginning. And then the primary thing we noticed was just the delay of language, just, you know, 2, 3, 3.5, 4, just no language, no words, would point, would kind of make some sounds, but just didn't have any expressive language. And that was kind of the main issue that, we noticed, at that time.
Was it a relief to get a label, or was it a burden to get a label?
I would say a bit of both. In the beginning, it was a little bit, there were, some unknowns. We took him to several different clinics in Detroit and in Grand Rapids, in Michigan at the time. They kind of did their assessments, including making sure he didn't have any hearing deficits. He had imaging to make sure he didn't have any structural brain abnormalities. But once we kind of had a diagnosis, it was somewhat of a relief, but it was also somewhat anxiety provoking. And it was sad. I mean, we were sad. We were not because, we were just sad about what that would mean for him, what that might mean for our family. We didn't have any experience with any personal family members with any special needs. And so we were kind of uncertain, anxious, a little sad. We knew what was happening, but it took a little while to kind of work through those emotions.
I bet. And your wife, you said, now works in special needs. Was she on that path already, or did your son influence that? Okay.
So this was a call to action for her a little bit, to learn as much as she could about it, and then to try and apply that knowledge to, help other children and other families.
And if these are two personal questions, Justin, just give me a look, but have your other children kind of integrated him into their world?
Things have gone about as well as I think you could. Trevor, who's our middle son with autism, he can speak now and communicate mostly normally, although some of his phrasing is still a little funny about how he'll describe things. But our older daughter, who's 4 years older, she was really mature for her age her whole life in terms of schoolwork, in terms of telling when other people were sad or wrong or helping out. And so she's really been a blessing for our family and for Trevor. And then a son who's 4 years younger, he's also integrated well within the family. Neither of them have any special needs or anything. And so we feel actually kind of blessed that he has an older sibling and a younger sibling who can kind of look out for him in the future. He's also got aunts and uncles that love him very much. So, because that was a concern. What if something happens to me or Amy, my wife? Who's going to take care of him? Where's he going to live? I mean, you start thinking about all of these things. I think we've had a lot of family support. Our other two children are very supportive. And so I think we're in a good situation that way.
Let's turn the focus back on you. So you left the University of Colorado and your first job was Petoskey, Michigan, which I believe is where Petoskey Stone comes from.
It is. It's where the Petoskey Stone comes from. So if you know Michigan, it's in the lower peninsula, but it's about as high as you can get, north as you can go, and still be in the lower peninsula. It's a small town. It has about a year-round population of about 15,000. But in the summer, it swells to about 45,000. So the population about triples. And that's because 3 months out of the year, July, August, and September, Petoskey, Michigan is ideal. It is ideal. It is ideal weather. It's ideal breeze. It's ideal water activities. It's ideal hiking. It's ideal biking, golfing. I mean, anything you could think of doing for those 3 months, it is ideal. You don't need a heater in your home. You don't need an air conditioner in your home. There's no mosquitoes there. It is truly, truly ideal. And so people from Chicago, people from Detroit, people from Florida and Arizona, they just go up there for those 3 months. And so we would have a lot of cancer patients that we would share with, Karmanos Cancer Institute in Detroit or Mayo Clinic in Phoenix or wherever. They would come up there for the summer to spend the time up there because it was ideal for those 3 months. Then the other months were kind of cold, windy, and or snowy. but for 3 months, it is ideal.
Yeah, of course, you lived there for the 12-month period, so
yes. You
got to experience all of it.
Yeah. I got to experience all of it, but yeah, it was interesting. It was just the population would really swell in the summer, and that made it fun. It was fun to see more people and do more things, and as a result of that, Petoskey was a town that would have that had a little bit more than you'd expect from a town of its size in terms of cultural things. So they had an art center and a musical group, and they had quite a few very nice restaurants and things that would cater to that summertime a boom of patients or in population. And so it was really kind of a small town, but it felt more like a bigger town. The other thing I should mention is that surrounding Petoskey, there's quite a few other much smaller towns. So we worked at a hospital that was rural, but we were a regional referral center for a kind of a catchment area that was pretty wide geographically. So even though the town itself would only have about a 15,000 year-round population, it would serve an area of about 150,000 patient people if you looked all around kind of the geographic area where patients would go to if they had any sort of serious medical problem. So Petoskey had, you know, cardiac surgeons, neurosurgeons, radiation oncology was there. So it was kind of a referral hospital too, which again was more than you'd expect from a town of its size if it were in a different setting.
How many medical oncologists were there?
Four. So there were four medical oncologists and two radiation oncologists.
And I think you went with another University of Colorado fellow.
Yes, I did. Todd Erickson. Yes. We were friends and we both went there, and we were there both there for 4 years and then kind of went separate ways. One of the things about Petoskey is, even though it's a great town and there's, you know, a lot of support, great hospital, we didn't have any family there. And the services that our son needed in terms of his autism and things, they just weren't what he needed there. And so we felt like we needed to, A, get closer to family for family support, and then B, get in a kind of a larger city that would have more, you know, services available for him. And so that was kind of a primary reason that we left after 4 years for those two reasons.
Did your loans get paid off in 4 years?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be the other reason.
That would be the other reason. But the idea there would be the hope that you're there for 4 years, your kids are in school there, you're integrated community there, you just want to stay.
Yeah.
And we would have, or we would have considered it. We really liked the area. I liked the hospital. I liked everything about there, working there, but it wasn't a good fit for our family at that time.
I just got off a call with one of the oncology brothers, and we were talking about the challenges of, you know, working in relatively small practices when you're a generalist. And so when you and Todd arrived, you know, you doubled the number of medical oncologists there.
We did. So there were three there, one retired, but then they needed two more because they were growing. So there were three, then one retired, and then we two. So it was both, but yeah, it was essentially doubling it or at least increasing it by another full-time physician.
But when you first go there, tell me, and again, I've always been an academic. I've always been a specialist. I remember what it was like studying in my first lung cancer clinic, but I only had to know about one thing. Yeah. So what was it like? I mean, I guess you know, the question is, did those other people, did they mentor you? Did they check in on you? Or were you kind of like, okay, Dr. Cole, let me know if there's any problems. Bye.
A bit of both. They definitely checked in on me, but I was kind of not on my own, but seeing our panel of patients. And in community practice, there's two things I would say. One is we're very grateful for the NCCN guidelines. Those are so helpful in terms of at least understanding what the current standard of care is. And the other thing that we kind of say in community practice is, you know, because you can go quite a while without seeing a particular type of cancer. It wouldn't be unusual for me, for example, to go 9 months without seeing any bladder cancer patients at all. And then when I see one on my schedule, I'm like, oh, I've got to go kind of bone up. I've got to know what's happened in that. And so the joke is, as a community oncologist, you have 10 minutes to become an expert, meaning you this is what you're doing, but you got to, okay, I see this. Okay, I got 10 minutes to become an expert. And that's a challenge of it, of trying to keep up to date with everything. And the NCCN guidelines are very helpful at doing that. But what they don't give is the nuances of the treatments, the experience with toxicity management and dose adjustment. They don't go into the details of the clinical trials about what subgroups might or might not have benefited, at least not to the detail that I think a lot of, you know, disease-focused oncologists would know. And so that's kind of a challenge, but I think it's just that's the role of a community oncologist is to try and do that. Tumor boards are helpful. We had tumor boards in Michigan. We have tumor boards here, so you can bounce ideas off colleagues. You know, I've never been a solo practitioner. I think that would be very difficult. So even in Michigan or here, if I am in a situation where I'm not sure what to do, I can at least talk to 8 different people about what they would do. And so that's very helpful too. But yeah, it is a challenge to try and keep up. When I started, what I would do is I would get the patient list from the next day. And at night at home, after the kids were asleep, I would look up each patient that I was going to see the next day to try and prepare for what was happening. And if I needed to look up something that night, I would. I did that for about 9 or 10 months until you kind of got familiar enough where you felt like you didn't need to do that. Like, okay, I can go into a clinic and I don't know, I haven't looked at the schedule, who's coming in tomorrow, but I know I can manage it. But as a recent, you know, fellow completing fellowship and going into a community practice, it's hard to have that confidence. And so I would get that patient list, look them up, each patient, and kind of say, okay, they've got colon cancer. This is what, oh, I need to look this up or I need to do something in order to prepare for the next day.
I have to tell you, I still do that. So I write down a plan for every one of my patients for the following day's clinic. Yeah. And I go through it with the team before the clinic starts. And then, of course, you know, real world intervenes and my plan is completely nonsense. I'm, you know, faced with the person in the room. So then we go through it all again at the end of the clinic. So are you telling me that now you just walk into a room without knowing anything about the patient?
No. So maybe I better rephrase that. And the reason I did that before was that process of learning and bringing yourself up to speed with the patients the day before, I would spend about 2 hours doing that. So let's say from 8:30 at night to 10:30 at night, I would be, you know, kind of going into that detail. But now I can get to work. I get to work at 7 a.m. and I can just do it in 20 or 30 minutes. So I still do it. I just don't do it the night before. I don't spend the same time doing it. We definitely prepare ahead of time for each and every day. So I may have maybe given a false impression.
Well, it would be different from the Justin Cole that I know if you were just like winging in there going, yeah. And what's up with you?
Yeah, I would know. But in terms of like the night before, so I'm not doing that at home anymore. I'm kind of saying I can do it the next day on the day of the clinic before coming in or before the first patient comes in to kind of prepare. So we definitely prepare. It's just not. I guess I can do it in a more efficient way than I did coming out of fellowship.
When, after 4 years, you decided to move closer to home and go back to Utah, were you looking for the same kind, you know, within the limits of, you know, urban versus rural, you know, the same kind of practice?
So I was looking for community practice. One of the other things I should tell you about community practice that I particularly like is that I don't answer to any administrators. And that was something that was a challenge in Petoskey, where there was a hospital, it was a hospital employed position. And I had a boss and a kind of the president of a hospital. And so if we felt like we needed something, we needed an additional receptionist or we needed an additional nurse, or we needed kind of priority for our patients when their blood went to the central lab so that we weren't waiting an hour and a half for a CBC. We couldn't just make that decision on our own. We had to ask and explain and, you know, kind of justify. And I understand that, and that's okay. But sometimes it's hard to try and justify it to people that don't have, they're not boots on the ground. They're not in the trenches. They're kind of looking from a distance at some other metric and kind of making a decision on that. And in a community practice, we definitely have a CEO and a CFO and people who help run the business, but it's the doctors that are in charge. And I think that makes a big difference. So if I'm, you know, when my productivity or things are being reviewed, and we review that every 6 months as a practice, if I have to justify myself to my partners, that's a lot different than if I have to justify myself to somebody who I have met once or see once a year or something. And so it's just, I like that environment better, because the people who I'm working with, the decision makers, are my partners with boots on the ground. And that was important. And so I kind of wanted to join a group that had that same philosophy. And I found that in Utah Cancer Specialists.
So we're going to get into how you end up a kind of born again academic.
Yes.
But when you start in Utah, so what year did you start back in Utah?
2012.
Okay. And so at that point, were you doing the same general oncology practice? When did the idea of clinical trials sort of come back to you?
So when I joined Utah Cancer Specialists, there was a pre-existing clinical trials program at Utah Cancer Specialists. It was mostly phase 3 trials, and there were maybe, I would say, about 12 to 15 different trials. And they were trials like you'd expect, like in one trial for adjuvant HER2-positive breast cancer, looking at adjuvant whatever, or first-line metastatic colon cancer, first-line metastatic lung cancer. So kind of the tumor types that we would see commonly in a community practice, and phase 3 trials where they're not competitive, we're not fighting for slots, the trials open at dozens and dozens and dozens of places. It's a relatively simple study schema, and it's something that we can do. And so that program existed, that phase 3 program. And so we had that, and I was part of that, and we would enroll. I wasn't a principal investigator for any of those trials. One of the other physicians was when I joined. But then in 2016, so about 4 years later, I kind of started to talk with my partners, and that time I become a partner. So when you first join a partnership, you don't become a partner, you have to kind of pay your dues. So I paid my dues for 3 years, became a partner, and the partnership is they want to make sure that you're productive, that you're carrying your own weight, and then also that you're a kind of a fairly quasi-normal human being. Like you're pleasant to work with, the staff likes you, you show up when you're on call, you don't kind of, you know, if it's Sunday afternoon and there's 5 consults, you go in and see those on Sunday afternoon. You don't save them for your partner to do on Monday morning. These are kind of the professionalism that they just want to make sure that people have to become a partner in the group.
Let me ask you a question there. So first of all, how big is the group that you joined?
So when I joined, there were about 12 partners, and I joined as an employed physician. So that was about the size of it then. And now it's 21 physicians.
Oh, where?
And I think 16 partners.
Okay. And then what's the advantage of being a partner? You get a cut of the profits. Is it as simple as that?
It's a partner / owner.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, after the, you know, it's a business and the revenue and the cost and all that, then yes, you are liable for either the debts or able to receive the profits in any given year of how the business is doing. That's right.
And the business, in this case, let me just confirm, you own your own infusion center?
Yes.
Do you own imaging?
Yes. So we have our own infusion center at multiple different locations. We have our own CT scanner and PET CT. We have a linear accelerator. and we have a dedicated outpatient pharmacy so that all of the oral cancer drugs we try and fill through that pharmacy. We also own lab equipment, so all of the CBCs and CMTs that go through our process through our office. So it's kind of medical oncology, imaging, radiation oncology, lab, pharmacy. And then we do have a supportive care program. So we have a physician, a palliative care physician, and two nurse practitioners who are palliative care trained, and they see only oncology patients with our practice. So we kind of have that as well.
Do you have to, this gets into the business zone. Do you have to underwrite the supportive care? Because
you do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Financially, yes. It saves time, but yes, if that were a standalone business entity, it wouldn't be feasible economically.
But, and I just want to give a shout out to not just being a slave to the bottom line and actually recognizing that some things add value, even if they're not profitable.
Yeah. If I can tout our own group's horn, we really care about patients' out-of-pocket cost. And so sometimes, there are drugs or new drugs or biosimilars that get approved and they're branded so they can charge more, but they offer no benefit other than cost. And I'm proud to say that our group has chosen not to do that because it adds to patients' deductibles. It adds to their out-of-pocket costs. So it's not just a ruthless cutthroat entity. It's a business for sure. But I'm really proud of our partners and the group to who are making these decisions, not just on our, but factoring in what our patients are going through, both emotionally, psychologically, physically, but also financially. We're attuned to that, and we don't want to increase cost to patients, to improve our margin. It just doesn't sit well with the kind of the goal of a caring physician. So it doesn't mean that we don't care about the business. We do, of course, but the decisions are made not just with that solely in mind. And supportive care is one of those examples where it's important to provide, and we can provide it within the structure of our practice.
I love it. So, okay, I interrupted your story. So you've been made a partner. Yes. And then do you feel you have a seat at the table to negotiate your plans for world domination?
So at our group, once you become a partner, all partners are equal, whether you've been a partner for 20 years or whether you've been a partner for 1 month. So once you're a partner, it's all equal. So everybody has a say. And so when I became a partner, I kind of wanted to ask about whether or not we could try and open some phase one trials in our practice. With you and my time at University of Colorado, that's where I spent most of my time, was in the GI clinic and phase one clinic. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed kind of working as part of clinical trials, especially early phase clinical trials. That was what my fellowship was kind of focused on. But we really didn't have a model to do that in the community. But we kind of said, well, okay, can I have some time to try and do this? And they said, yes. So I was given 2 hours a week to start to open a phase one program.
Like a long lunch break.
But it quickly, and some of the phase one trials we opened initially were not that interesting. They were kind of drug-drug interaction studies. But what they had was PK requirements. They had ECG requirements. So we had to add the capability of doing that in terms of, clinical trial coordinators, research equipment, drug storage equipment, PK processing equipment. But we were doing it on a very boutique kind of low end level. But we opened about six or seven trials, and we would enroll about 12 to 15 patients a year. I got up to where I was doing it half day a week. Monday afternoons was kind of my phase one time. And, but we, so we were doing it. We were kind of getting up and rolling. We had some novel antibody therapies and things, nothing that would require overnight stay, nothing that would require anything really all that complicated. But we were able to do that. And we did that from, I did that from 2016 until 2020 through Utah Cancer Specialists. So we had an office, that's where patients would come, and we would enroll them on those trials.
When you went from phase three to phase one, you didn't just think about having a middle ground and saying, I'm going to open some phase two studies?
Well, I didn't. I was kind of more interested in phase one.
Okay.
We subsequently do have several phase two trials, but my experience is that during that time, the number and phase two trials or dedicated phase two trials, that kind of went down because a lot of the dose expansion and kind of early efficacy signals were kind of moved into phase one in these dose expansion cohorts. At least that's what we're seeing now, where, you know, they might enroll, and we have one phase one trial that's enrolled over 400 patients on the trial because they have so many expansion cohorts. They're basically doing like six phase two studies in this phase one, our non-randomized phase two. And so we do have some phase two trials through our late phase program, but my focus was always on phase one.
So, I mean, I totally agree with you. The idea of, like, instead of writing a whole nother trial, you just sort of expand out, you know, your phase one study. But when you do that, I mean, how do you, when you get to those expansion cohorts, do you push it out to other physicians?
Yeah. So you bring up a good point of how to execute a trial in a community practice. So in a phase three trial, all of the physicians at every office are sub-investigators on that trial. And the reason that we want to do that is because if you have a patient in your community practitioner, community doc, and you have a breast cancer patient and they're eligible for a trial, what we'd like is for the patient to be able to participate on that trial at that location, the location where they're already at. And so we developed SOPs for drug transport from our central pharmacy to any number of these satellite offices. So on a phase three trial, patients could participate on that trial regardless of who their individual doctor was and regardless of where they got their treatment. So it really lowered a barrier to say, hey, if you want to be on a trial, well, we can do it just right here. I can do it. We can do it right here. Phase one doesn't kind of work like that for two reasons. One is because at almost every visit, there's some sort of PK blood draw. So you can't just draw it, you know, 30 miles away and drive it down in the back of a car. You've got to process it that day. Sometimes they require sending out that day. So patients have to come there for that. And then a lot of the assessments are just more intense. They need ECGs and they need this and that. And so a phase one program really doesn't work. You can't really execute a phase one program the same as you can a phase three program.
Okay.
You can't have 20 sub-investigators on a phase one trial, at least we can't. And you can't have the patient be treated at any one of 13 offices because the equipment there, the personnel there, you just can't do it. So when we were up, when we opened the phase one program at Utah Cancer Specialists, it was one office, one location, and every patient had to come there. Well, if they had to come there, then I need to be the doctor on that. So I would take over from their primary oncologist while they were on the trial. And they would drive to Salt Lake. They would be part of that trial. And then when they were done, if we had another trial they were interested in, we would do that. Or if they went back, then we'd send them back to their primary oncologist or referring oncologist. Then they would either get standard of care treatment or do a phase three trial. So that's how we kind of had to focus the phase one trial specifically at one location with one PI.
So I get that. And that's certainly how you and I started, where, you know, phase one was the, you know, please send me your huddled masses and, you know, you did what you did. And maybe there were other options and you could send them back. But no, my question was, when you get something which is a phase one, two study, and they add in, you know, five expansion cohorts in different lines and different tumor types, how do you execute that?
Okay, so that's a good question. That is more challenging. So what we, because in those expansion cohorts, usually the thing that, one of the things that changes in terms of eligibility is the line of therapy restrictions. So usually they'll say, okay, well, you know, dose escalate in maybe not all comers, but a number of different tumor types. No restriction on lines of prior therapy as long as they meet the other eligibility criteria. But once you get into dose expansion, the kind of their key metric is efficacy, usually response rate, and also duration of response. So they don't want to study it in expansion in people who've had 8 lines of prior therapy because nothing is going to work very well in that setting. So they move their lines of therapy up. So that's a challenge. And what we try and do, so what we've done is to say to our referring oncologists, you know, we don't want, you know, one option is to, you know, do every FDA approved treatment you can do. And then once you don't have anything left, then you can refer to phase one. But that mindset doesn't allow efficient enrollment in these expansion cohorts. Most of the expansion cohorts will say 3 lines of prior therapy. Some will have 2, but it's usually not just one. There's usually, they can have more than one line of prior therapy, either 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. So what we've tried to tell our referring doctors is we would like to see, and this is different now because I'm doing it full time and we have a bigger clinic and bigger capacity, but we would like to see every metastatic solid tumor patient who's on second line or later therapy. We would like to see them and let them know about these trials. Because if we see them while they're in second line, then these expansion cohorts become options. If we see them in 5th line or 6th line, we're trying to do some all-comer trial that, you know, and it just, it's not as successful. So that is that's a good question. And it the solution is, when do we see these patients as a dedicated phase one program? And it involves changing the mindset from phase one is what you do before hospice to phase one is really what we should be thinking about earlier. That doesn't mean we put all patients who are going on to third line on a phase one trial. It just means we want them to be aware of these because some of these drugs in dose expansion, they would be, I think, better options than other FDA approved drugs in third line.
Yeah. So I'm getting slightly ahead of myself. So you've gone from a long lunch hour to half a day. And then, Yes. And now you're full time. So hold on, fill in the gap for me.
Yeah. So everything changed in 2020, which was right at the peak of the COVID pandemic. So our practice, Utah Cancer Specialist, was approached by START, which is headquartered in San Antonio, Texas, about whether we'd like to open a dedicated community-based phase one clinical trial program in Salt Lake City, affiliated with Utah Cancer Specialists. And the START kind of model has 2 main ideas. One is that phase one trials are best done if people do them full-time. Not just physicians, not just pharmacists, not just nurses, not just coordinators, but everybody. If it's your full-time endeavor, you can do it well, and you can do it efficiently. And second is in a community setting. And those are kind of 2 things that were not on my radar in 2020. I wasn't thinking, hey, this is something I want to do full time or that I could even feasibly do full time. And so that was kind of the difference. And so what we kind of did an analysis of how many patients we see, how many referring oncologists we have, what would it take to kind of get that set up and get it off the ground? And we decided to kind of make an investment to try and do that. So we got some dedicated clinic space. We hired dedicated pharmacists, dedicated coordinators, dedicated nurses. We got dedicated equipment in terms of ECG machines, drug storage, PK storage, centrifuges. I mean, all the things you need to turn a phase one program. And we kind of, and I started doing this all time right at the beginning of 2021. So about almost coming up on 5 or 6 years ago now. And so we've, and since when I started, I was the only physician here. I was on call for our patients for about 2.5 years straight. I didn't take a vacation outside the United States. COVID helped because it was difficult not to do that. We had one sub-investigator who would kind of cover when I was out on vacation, but the staff essentially called me with what to do. So it was kind of an investment to try and get that up. And now we've got 3 full-time investigators. We've got a nurse practitioner who's here most of the time. We've got north of 60 different phase 1 trials now. And so it's really a growing endeavor.
And how many accruals do you have a year at the moment?
So we're enrolling on average about 15 patients per month, which is 180 per year right now.
That's really impressive. And why did Start reach out to you?
So they were looking to expand their model. And in order to have a successful community-based, dedicated phase 1 trial program, you have to have the referrals. And who refers to a program like that are other medical oncologists. So you have to have a group of medical oncologists who are going to refer patients to you. So in order for it to work, it has to be affiliated with a community practice of some size. A 3-physician group isn't going to generate enough referrals for one doctor to do it full time. You need to have 10 physicians who are referring. So Utah Cancer Specialist has, 20 physicians other than me. So that's enough to have enough referrals to generate this program. About 1/3 of our referrals now come from outside Utah Cancer Specialists. So there's other physicians in the Valley. We get referrals from other academic medical centers, including the University of Utah. We get referrals from Intermountain Health. So it's kind of a growing referral network that we have now as well.
How do you communicate either just the general awareness of phase 1 studies or specific studies, to that referral network?
Yeah. So by 2 reasons, but then I'll explain why I think neither of these 2 reasons are all that important. So 1 is with Utah Cancer Specialists, which is about 70% of our referrals. I meet with the physicians every month at our practice meeting, and we go over the trials that we have, not in a lot of detail, but especially in ones that are new or the ones that would be easy for them to remember. So, for example, we have 4 trials for any KRAS mutation at all. It doesn't matter what it is. Okay. So if they're seeing a patient and they know they have any sort of KRAS mutation, we have 4 trials for them. Well, we would want to make that easy for them to remember. If they have any patient that has any PIK3CA mutation, doesn't matter what the tumor type is, we have a trial for them. And so we're trying to communicate those types of things that are easy to remember. We send out an email about every 2 weeks with our trial list. But I've been on the other end of those emails. It's hard to remember. It's hard to remember all those trials when you're seeing 20 some odd patients a day as a busy practitioner and you can't remember. So the most important thing we say is, look, to our referring doctors, you can spend all the time you would like to try and learn the trials, but you don't need to. You don't need to know what trials we have. We say this respectfully. You don't need to know, but what you need to know is that we have a lot of trials with promising drugs that we would like to educate you and patients about in the second line or later setting. And so when you make a referral to Start, what we want to say is, hey, we're on second line therapy or third line therapy. And, I want to, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I want you to let you know that our practice has a dedicated clinical trials program. It's in a special office at a special center. They have a lot of different trials there. I think it would be important that you go there, that you meet with Dr. Call, that he tells you about these trials so that you know at least what the options are and that I know at least what the options are. And that's it. And if the patient asks, well, what are those trials do? What are the drugs? That's a good question. They have so many promising treatments, they'll explain it to you there. Or the drugs oral or IV? That's a great question. There's a lot of promising trials they have. They'll explain it to you there. How often are the visits? That's a great question. They'll explain it to you. So you don't have to know a lot about the trials. It's just because, as you might expect, almost every patient we see has never been on a trial.
Yeah.
So they don't know. So they're there to learn. They're there to, so that we can kind of know them, they can meet us, and we can tell them what's available. And once they've done that, then we send a note and an email back to the referring doctor. If it makes sense for them to go on a trial, that's great. If they continue on their current treatment and then they progress, when we see them back, we're not having to explain what a phase one trial is, what they're, we just kind of pick up from where we left off and we can try and, you know, present options to them.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask was, I'm going to give you the good and bad of phase one. So we'll start with the good. So the good is you can be the first person in the world to see an efficacy signal for something that nobody had any expectation in. You may or may not remember this, but you know, when you and I worked together, we had a class of drugs that were brand new. They were called death receptor agonists.
I remember.
And we had a lady who had a sarcoma that nothing worked in. And we put her on one of these things and everything shrank down. And then she got whatever was left behind resected and it was all dead. And she did amazingly well. And here we are, you know, oh my goodness, you know, nearly 20 years later. And those drugs are just now entering registrational studies in sarcoma. And you just go, so, you know, you have a multi-year lead in terms of getting access to the breakthrough. So that's the positive side. The negative side is they're not all success stories. And so I'm going to exaggerate this as a fear. So I send you one of my patients and let's say they have a sarcoma and I want to put them on a death receptor agonist trial and I send them to you, but that trial's closed or you don't have one because I don't know which trials you've got. And you just say, I've got a gap in this trial and you just enroll them because, you know, trial X needs someone.
Yes. I think that's a valid concern. And I can see where you might, I mean, that might be a, but what I tell patients, and I truly believe this, is if they're going to volunteer to be on an early, you know, phase one trial, early human testing of an experimental cancer drug, that's the decision that they're going to make, then I think it's really important to have buy-in from the physicians who are caring for that patient. And so what we will do is, because sometimes we'll get a patient, pancreatic cancer is the typical example. That's a high one that we see. And let's say they've got a KRAS G12 whatever mutation, and we don't have a slot on that trial, and they need something right away. But we do have an antibody drug conjugate trial. Well, I'll tell the patient about both and explain kind of the timing. And then I'll send an email to their referring doctor and say, hey, we saw Mr. Jones here. These are the trials that we were thinking about. This is one that we could wait on and try and hold out, or this is one we could start right away. What do you think? And if they say, hey, you know, yeah, we don't have anything else, which is mostly the case for pancreatic cancer, that sounds great. Then we get support and buy-in from the referring physician too. And that sometimes happens where they get referred for a specific trial, but either they don't qualify for that trial, or what's more common is we don't have a slot that we can start in 3 or 4 weeks, and so, or even less. And so we want to communicate that to the patient. I don't think it makes sense to put a patient on a study where there's really, I mean, well, you can come up with some scenarios where, hey, they've got pancreatic cancer, there's nothing left, they want to try something, this is something. Yeah. But we're really trying to select a trial that we think will be beneficial for them based on what treatments they've had before, what treatments they haven't had before. And so we don't want to just try and fill some quota about saying, hey, let's do what's not in this patient's best interest to make our numbers look better. And part of that is getting buy-in from the referring physicians about the trial. And so sometimes I'll say, hey, we've got this, you know, for breast cancer, that we've got this CDK24 degrader. Is this something they'd be interested in? And I'll email them back and the referring doctor will say, no, I'm going to start in HER2. I said, great, that's great. And just keep this trial in mind for the future. So I think it is important to have that communication with the referring doctor so that it doesn't come as a, you know, that we're kind of making these decisions that if they didn't know or weren't quite aware, they might be thinking, why did they put him on that trial? That doesn't make sense. And so we definitely want to be cognizant of that.
You know, it's interesting that when you and I were doing phase ones together nearly 20 years ago, the primary focus was not efficacy.
Right.
The primary focus was, you know, you're doing this for the betterment of society. And if you benefit, you know, way to go. But the odds are you won't. It'll be like one in 20. Whereas now, you know, we can have efficacy even at some of the lowest doses of these drugs. So it's just an interesting observation how that's changed.
Right. Well, and we get, you know, when we see a patient, a common question for us is, well, how many trials do you have? And when we say 60, they say, oh, gee. Well, why did you choose this one? Why are you telling me about this one? Is this one the best one? You know, and we kind of say, well, no, we don't know if one's best or not. They're all kind of in the same boat, but we're not just picking one at random. We're trying to pick one, well, A, that you would be eligible for, that qualify for. And if there's tumor type restrictions on eligibility, and we've got to choose one that matches your tumor type. But more than that, we're trying to choose something that's different, that involves a treatment mechanism that's different than you've had before, or that's something that's targeting a mutation that we know you have, or you know your cancer cells have, for which there's no current FDA-approved treatment. You know, KRAS G12C, for example, for endometrial cancer, or something like that, where there's an approved drug, but it's not for their tumor type. These are the trials that we're trying to look at for them. So it's not just a random selection, or one that we say, well, you know, we haven't enrolled a patient on this trial for 8 months. You got to get our quota up. So let's talk about this. I can tell you those thoughts really don't enter my mind. They don't, because I have to live with myself too. Yeah. And I would, if this were my mom or my sister, what would I want? You know, and I wouldn't want them to be put on some trial for a quota. We just, and I'm sure that may happen somewhere, but that's really, I would have a hard time sleeping with myself if we were doing that.
And, you know, that is the Justin call that I know. So as we get near to time, my question is, you're the start of this, and you've built it from the ground up, you know, with your own set of, you know, personal values in there. How do you scale it? How do you make sure other people have the same ethical standards that you do, for want of a better term?
It's hard to scale. And one of the things that makes it hard, I mean, the trials are complicated, the assessments are complicated, all that, the patients are sick. But one of the things that makes it hard is, and it's hard for me, is that I feel like I have actually three different clients. So one is the patient, and we care about the patient experience. We care about having a environment where they feel comfortable. We care that their calls are returned the same day. We care that their questions are answered. So that's really important. The second client is the referring physicians. So we rely on them completely to get the patients into our office. So we want to communicate well with them. We want to explain why we're making decisions. We want to let them know what's happening and why, and keep them updated. And then the third client are the sponsors, the pharmaceutical companies. And one of the things that I think, at least a lot of physicians, I think even oncologists, don't appreciate, who don't do phase one, is that phase one trials are competitive. They're competitive at every level. So for example, when we're, you know, and if a sponsor is going to open a phase one trial for dose escalation, they might select 5 or 6 sites to open that phase one trial. Well, how are they selecting those sites? It's not random. They're looking at metrics, and we know what those metrics are. They're looking at time from initial protocol to IRB approval. They're looking at time from initial protocol received to SIV date. They're looking at time from SIV date to time of first patient enrolled. I mean,
I'm going to translate. Institutional Sorry. Review board, site initiation visit. Oh, and by the way, PK is pharmacokinetics, drug levels in blood.
Yes. Yeah. So So if they're looking at those things, then we're competing with other sites to get those trials. But then once the trial is open, we're also competing for other sites for those slots. So some slot allocation is pretty equitable, and some sponsors, I think, do it better than others. But some, it's like, we'll send in these patients, and then we'll let you know once a month whether your patient was selected or not. That's it. There's no way we can plan for that. We don't know how to compete if that's the slot allocation. So they're competitive, and that's different than phase three trials. Phase three trials, you know, 50 sites or more. There are 500 patients on each arm. Let's open it as many and just go, just kind of get the truck rolling. But they're competitive. And so it's that balance about how do you exist in a competitive environment, but still focus on the patient, which is one of our very important clients. And that gets into, I'm trying to answer your question in a little bit of a roundabout way of how you scale it. So what you have to do is you have to have systems and people in place so that it's an effort that's part of a team. And that's hard because what we've done so far is so every patient that goes on every trial, I have met them and I know them. I know every patient. But as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, that just can't happen. You can't make these decisions by committee. Somebody has to be in charge. And when we were talking earlier, it's either there's one person has to be in charge or nobody's in charge or everybody's in charge. And so scaling it is important. We have our phase one meeting every week, like a lot of where we review the trials and trainings and things. But we also have a separate meeting every week called, we call it patient huddle. And what that purpose of that meeting is to have everybody in that meeting where we're discussing the well-being of every patient. What are their issues? What problems are they having? So that everybody's kind of focused on that. And if patients have a good experience, and I'm sure you know this, Russ, when the drug doesn't work, and that's really disappointing, and they have a scan that shows it didn't work, and they turn to you and say, all right, doc, what trial do you have next? To me, that speaks volumes. It speaks volumes about, because they dedicated a lot of time, they dedicated a lot of energy for something that turned out not to benefit them, and they immediately want to try it again. Yeah. That says a lot about them, and it says, if that's what's happening in your program, I think that says a lot about the program because people feel comfortable there. They feel like, hey, I was taken care of. I got an opportunity to try. I really had a good experience here and I want to try it again. And that we call it patient retention across different trials. And we see that quite a bit. I think our record is 7 trials. We have one patient, actually it's a patient with EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer was diagnosed in 2018, who had brain metastasis at that time. She's still alive in 2025 and has been on 7 different trials.
Wow.
And it's just, you know, unheard of. And we say, well, you know, and sometimes people will come off a trial and we'll say, well, you know, we've got another trial, but we can also, you know, I'll touch base with Dr. So-and-so, your primary oncologist, and see if they have anything that they would want to meet you and talk with you about. And they're like, no, I'm good. Just tell me about the other trial. I'm interested. Let me know what it is and all. And so that kind of patient experience is really important. And we're small enough to be able to provide that as we grow and scale. That is a concern. That is a concern about what that patient experience will be, how much personalization will they feel. We're very cognizant of that. In thinking about how we enroll patients and how we think about their experience.
So, well, you didn't give me an answer though. You just said you worry about it.
I don't have an exact answer other than we have a culture. What the kind of the mission of Starter is hope through access, meaning we're giving hope through access for these drugs that patients otherwise wouldn't be able to receive. And there's a business part of it. There's a sponsor part of it. but without the referral. And you know, if you refer somebody, your patient, to some other program and you get lousy feedback, you're like, hey, I went there. They didn't know why I was there. They had no clue what was going on. I saw the doctor for 5 minutes. I came out more confused. Well, if that's the feedback you get, you're not going to refer patients there again.
Yeah.
And so the patient experience is really fundamental. And how we grow that, it's just, I think it's going to be kind of a organic thing where we just have to kind of continually focus on that, even though there's these other demands of, you know, the metrics and the competition for, you know, as part of these trials.
You need another just in call who then sort of creates, you know, little sort of spin-offs. Well, no, not even that, but sort of, you know, you can maintain this boutique approach by essentially replicating the whole team multiple times as opposed to just growing one team.
Right. Well, that's right. That's one way to think about it. And yeah, we think a lot about that. And about, you know, if this were our mom coming in here, what would we want her to experience? How would we want her to be listened to and things? And it's important. And that's good advice, Ross. I'm going to think about that more.
Well, it's actually been fascinating catching up with you. Thank you for sharing your journey, and I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you, Ross. I really appreciate it. It was very much enjoyable for me too. I hope it's interesting for some. And if I might give one plug to potential listeners, is there are now opportunities to do phase 1 trials in a community setting. And so if people, you know, I didn't know that was a possibility, but it is. And START's not the only entity that's doing this. There are others. And so it's kind of a way to be, you know, involved in research and what we like to think at the cutting edge, but to not then do it as, you know, a formal university setting. That just exists. That's all I want to communicate.
And you're still a generalist, and you know, you are, because phase 1s are multi-tumor type.
They're right. They're multi-tumor type. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Ross. Great catching up with you as well.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.